On Christmas night of 2021, Asheville police descended on Aston Park to clear out a couple dozen people, some of them homeless, and their belongings after a city-imposed 10 p.m. curfew.
Park is closed. You must leave now or you will be arrested.
Except
you understand?
For the fact that I am actually working.
You're under arrest.
Whoa, are you serious?
Among those arrested were two people wearing press passes from the Asheville Blade. They say they were in the park covering what had been billed to them as a protest about how the city treats its homeless. Now, Veronica Coit and Matilda Bliss face an April 19th court date on charges of trespassing.
And now we have, for only the fourth time in the country since 2018, journalists being taken to trial for doing their jobs. And I think it definitely shows, like, beneath the progressive veneer, this is who Asheville's governments and legal structure are when the chips are down.
I'm Matt Pikin. Today on The Overlook, Matilda Bliss and Asheville Blade founding editor David Forbes talk with me about their coverage of homelessness in Asheville, the events of the night Bliss and Coit were arrested, and what they believe the existing charges say about freedom of the press and a city known for its progressivism. Advertisements don't sound like ads on The Overlook. They sound like conversations, because they are. Take it from one of my earliest sponsors, Jennifer Goodyear of Davidia Realty.
That was really easy, and I felt really comfortable doing this ad with you. And I'm enjoying it so much that I do want to buy more.
If you market a business, or even yourself, make a great impression by advertising on Asheville's hottest show. You can be a sponsor of The Overlook for as little as $100. Ask to learn more by messaging me at matt@podavl.com. That's podavl.com. I began our conversation by asking David Forbes about the background of the Asheville Blade.
The term Blade has an honorable history in news publishing. There were a lot of abolitionist and labor papers in the 1800s, and then some of the earliest professional queer media in the 50s, 60s, and 70s have used that term. So it's got a solid history behind it in the social justice front. We're a cooperative of journalists. We make decisions collectively about budget, about coverage. And obviously, if someone's experienced at something, we're really going to listen to that person. But we found it to be a really solid, powerful structure. And it, I think, brings the best aspects of journalistic colleagues sharing information, working well together, without some of what I saw working in kind of establishment newsrooms, where it's this weird top-down hierarchy where the publisher might appoint an editor who has no idea what's going on. I think this kind of more egalitarian setup works really well, both for our purposes and for the public's interests as well. In a way, I think we've gotten a masterclass in what journalism isn't supposed to be. So let's do the opposite of that. Let's go in depth. Let's openly confront power structures. Let's be way less concerned with the fancy restaurant opening up than how the people working there are paid and treated. And so that's the ethos that founded The Blade. I think also that media in this town, established media, can be conflict averse to a detriment. We're the opposite. We've always been, no, let's go confront. Let's get a sharp perspective out there that really shakes things up. If the rest of the press here is saying there's a crime wave when there isn't one, to use a recent example, let's really push back against that. If there's a perspective that's not being heard, let's put that front and center.
Interesting that you've been able to do this for a decade now, it seems. Yes. Like, where does your funding come from?
Readers. So we were one of the first news publications, I think, anywhere to use Patreon as a fundraising model. And that's something I'd seen too, is that even when there was like an ethical edit, when people were trying their best, if your funding is advertising based, then that is a certain constituency, one with a lot of wealth and power, that can put pressure on a publication. It's also not very resilient, because, you know, when times are good, there might be a lot of cash coming in, but something totally out of your control and your community's control can really put you on the back foot or even shut a publication down. So The Blade's more of a slow and steady wins the race kind of publication. We get $3, $5, $10 a month from various readers through that platform. Occasionally we do donation fundraising drives. We just had a really successful one on GoFundMe this past winter. And I think that also changes how the work goes, because that way we aren't dependent on any one single source. There's no way a small group of rich people can get pissed at our coverage and destroy the paper overnight the way they can with some advertising publications.
You've probably covered a wide range of issues, social issues, political issues, things that you've touched on that certain mainstream publications might be less bold about covering. Are there certain core beats
that the Blade has carved out for itself, or at least now, at least post-pandemic, post-George Floyd, Black Lives Matter? Are there certain core beats that the Blade wants to be the leader on?
We try to do longer form coverage generally. When certainly we have some live stuff on our social media. We've done live government coverage since we started. I think we bring a very critical eye to City Hall. We bring a similar eye to the tourism machine here. We've always brought an eye to labor, to police brutality. I think we're against power over, and we're for like power in community. And I think that informs stuff. We do a lot of COVID coverage. I think too, because we're not as tied to advertising, we can be honest about it. We're not looking to get back to normal and bring tourists and advertising dollars back. We're looking to be honest with people about what the risks are in this community from an event. We bring an eye to covering protests, to the unhoused situation, which we have since day one, but certainly has gotten worse as the cost of living's gotten worse and poverty's become even more of an issue here.
Talk about your coverage of homelessness specifically. And Matilda, I guess maybe I want you to talk about this.
Yeah, definitely.
So talk about your entry point into covering homelessness here in this town in the lead up to what happened at Afton.
I guess my first real introduction to that issue was, gosh, it was 2018, actually, sitting in on a TDA meeting a few months earlier. There was, for instance, like a list of like 15 of the biggest concerns, and like homelessness and panhandling was like 8. And that was all they talked about.
But I want you to specify that a little more in detail. You said they were pulling on this and that's all they were talking about. You mean hoteliers were talking to city council? What was happening? What were you hearing? Sure. And who, where were they pulling on these issues?
The TDA does have a council liaison at the time. It was Julie Mayfield. And I was tracking this. It was way before I became a Blade reporter, but it was something that stuck with me. And that experience definitely was like a driving force behind the tourism machine.
Make the connection for listeners between what you were seeing at the TDA and their priorities and your coverage of homelessness and what you were seeing on the ground.
Sure. That was a small snippet, of course. It became, you know, contributing to some coverage on Concerned Citizens, which was an article that we published in late 2019 about a bunch of far-right business owners. They were having these meetings and they were very obsessed with poverty. There wasn't even like violence that they were really citing. It was just visible poverty.
I think that's a huge point in this. I think Matilda was referring to, there was this big poll done of people in downtown, businesses in downtown, and houselessness wasn't even top of the list. It was way down. But you were going to these meetings, all that the people in power could talk about was seeing panhandlers, seeing the unhoused. And the ways that they referred to them were very dehumanizing. And then we end up in places like Aston Park as journalists, and or just a lot of us live in this city and we see the realities. And it was, I think, for a lot of us, I wrote Concerned Citizens, Matilda contributed that piece, and Matilda did the tourism machine and a lot of other coverage on this issue, which is the gap between the very dehumanizing, very clueless way that poverty and anyone, frankly, who doesn't like own 5 houses in a hotel is referred to in these TDA meetings or even at some government meetings. And then how you see things hitting the ground. Yeah. And there is a direct line between the policies that they pushed to set there, especially more police, more crackdowns, which is what they wanted when you saw those meetings and what they constantly still want now, and what with the number of evictions we have here, the number of camp evictions we have here. And also with the reason why 40% of the Asheville police force, who are their own numbers, have quit. And yet their budget keeps going up each year, even when we are the city with one of the worst costs of living in the country. There's so many other needs and they keep pouring cash towards that. Why? When you go to these meetings, it makes sense about who's prioritizing that and what they're prioritizing.
I can understand it if you are a hotelier and if your business is that we want to provide a pleasant experience for our visitors, if that's your business, I can understand why they would have a concern. What was your concern about them bringing this up to police and bringing this up as a topic to address?
Sure. I think when you look at those concerns about like economic impact, that just doesn't compare to what people are losing when they return. For instance, in February of 2021, folks who were camping on Lexington Avenue returning, it felt like 7 degrees and they had none of their belongings were there anymore. They'd been bulldozed. So then you have later on people returning to the Cherry Street camp and not being able to find any like family memorabilia, like just like trashed people's whole lives being uprooted. So that it just doesn't compare. I think that's the biggest thing, is that people's lives are at risk here.
So you'd been covering this, obviously, the Blade, and you, Matilda, in particular, had been covering or been at least witnessing what was going on with local homelessness for a while now. What was going on in Afton Park the night of what happened in Afton Park? What was advertised as the event, or what was happening, and what drew you there?
That week in December of 2021, there had been art builds, people making art in the park. We had covered what was happening there every night that had happened since the Sunday before the 19th.
So this was a succession of evenings, of consecutive evenings that things were happening there?
Yeah, yes. And it had gone through Wednesday or Thursday. Yeah. That. And so we had been there taking pictures and tracking what was happening. We had heard this very weird thing going on where the police were saying that their the ordinance on camping, as far as the 7-day notice policy.
7 days notice.
Yeah, which had not been changed yet, but they were saying it was going to be changing. So that's something that we were tracking. We were trying to keep an eye on, okay, are they going to enforce a policy that hasn't even changed yet?
Yeah. So I think it's also, there's a history at Afton Park. In April of 2021, there's a story called Eviction Season. Folks can read on this. Matilda and Veronica Coit, who was the other reporter, ended up getting arrested, and kind of what I think you're building up to. Afton Park has long been a site both for houseless camps. It is central to a lot of services. It is within sight of a lot of places where if you're unhoused in this town, you need to go to try to like have any hope of not having your life collapse completely. It has also been a site for protests. So this had long been a site for both protests and houseless folks. And so when we heard there was an event happening, we're like, okay, we need to have eyes on the ground on this and see what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, police had directed people to Afton Park in April of that year.
What do you mean they directed them to Afton Park?
When they would evict camps like the Cherry Street camp, they would tell people, why don't you go to Afton where you can basically set up without being like disturbed by us? Like in hindsight, corralling people there.
And we covered the Afton Park eviction when it ended up happening. And that there was a 7-day notice. Later, we uncovered documents that showed this was really being pushed for by wealthy people in the area, many of whom were transplants, had moved into what's historically been a Black working class neighborhood. And even though the public feedback the city was getting was overwhelmingly, hey, let the campers stay, find a way to provide some services. The people they were listening to were largely this much smaller group, much wealthier group, which was saying, you know, look, we don't want to see poor people. Basically, we want them gone.
If you own or run the marketing of a business in this region, nonprofit or for-profit, podcasting is a unique, engaging way to tell your story. These are called branded podcasts. Your company owns the show, and I'm here to help you put one together. It might be a short series or an ongoing production. You already know about the years of great work I did in public radio and now here with The Overlook. I also want to work for you through my studio, Podcast Asheville. Email me at matt@podavl.com. That's podavl.com. Let's talk and see how I can help you meet your marketing goals with a podcast that's all your own. I began the second half of the conversation by asking Matilda Bliss about that Christmas night in 2021, what they were seeing in Afton Park, and what led to their arrests.
I had been there mostly off and on, had tracked that people started setting up tents like in the late afternoon. There was a lot of camaraderie among the people that were there. It felt like a lot of people just sharing food, sharing stories, playing music. It was what anybody could call a very joyous scene.
Festive.
Yeah, for the festive. Season. I mean, it's Christmas. Yeah. It was Christmas. People were just sharing in community. There was no conflict that I recognize at all, which is often used as, oh, there's like violence happening there, so we have to clear the camp. None of that was happening. People were just hanging out with each other.
Was it under the premise of protest or of activism? Was there a sense that it wasn't just merely the unhoused who were just, hey, we're in Afton Park and this is where we can go? Was there a goal behind the gathering?
Well, I believe that there was a public statement that went out about come to Afton and share in community by Asheville Solidarity Network, which has promoted protests. There had always been this element of these things are happening in our community. Like the city's not funding Code Purple shelters. People are getting kicked out to make room for Airbnbs. People are hungry.
So it was about building awareness around the issues that the unhoused face here.
That was an element. That was an element. And one thing that's been explained since that happened was like there was like conversation about pallets going up. And if you think about it, pallets are used to break wind. And some of those nights were very cold. There was this element of building a safe container for people to be able to camp there.
Like safety features for nights when you have fridges. Exactly.
What did you see happening in terms of when the police moved in to do something about this? From your vantage, what were they want? What were police asking? What was happening and why did it escalate?
They were, again, saying that they didn't have to respect their own policy, that they could use the NC trespassing law to clear people out.
With no 7-day notice.
Exactly. And it's like, why is this separate standard? Why is sometimes they use it and other times they don't?
So, were they doing that under the guise of there's a 10 p.m. curfew? I heard something
about
that.
Yeah, that was what they were citing. And which, like, okay, I think from one perspective, like, it's a little bit predictable considering how the Asheville Police Department has acted in this town for ages. If they really want to do something, they're probably just going to do it and then deal with the consequences after that. We're tracking this. We want to see what's going on. This is a issue that's been covered by Citizen Times, Mountain Express, WLOS, and us. We've been covering it all week.
So when the police pushed in to, okay, we're putting an end to this, did they know who you were at all? Did they distinguish you and Veronica at all, to your knowledge, from the others who were the population that was there at that time?
I was never addressed by name. The body cam footage now that's been released.
Yes.
I was going to ask you about that.
There's never any, it doesn't seem like there's like a real acknowledge of me. There is one portion that kind of hints towards somebody knowing Veronica.
And I will point out, Veronica had been arrested acting as a Blade journalist before in August of 2020. Those charges were later dropped, but they were following a march in their car with their press pass on there, monitoring what was going on. And the police, and we're a publication, and our writers individually also were very critical of the police department. We're abolitionists. We're very upfront about where our position is and what our viewpoint is. And they dragged them out of their car and arrested them. Those charges were later dropped, but they definitely, I think, knew who Veronica was.
Which it should be stated that during the 2020 protests, when there was a curfew, that there was a specific media exemption.
Yeah.
That media
They realized that there is, that they, or at least they paid lip service, I think is a better way to put it, towards that, hey, journalists need to be able to use their First Amendment rights.
I believe they still threatened our reporters.
Oh, they did. And they did end up arresting one of them.
At some point, I'm sure when the police confronted you personally, you and Veronica, you said, we are journalists, correct? I would imagine you did.
I was wearing my press pass. I was, you know, saying I was a journalist. I have a First Amendment right to cover an event.
Talk about what you heard in return, a reply from the Asheville police when you did identify yourselves.
They basically said that it didn't matter and that if I didn't leave, I would be arrested. There was still stuff happening. So that's the key part, that I was in a park clearly identifying as press and there was a newsworthy event that was ongoing. We weren't directed towards a specific spot where media were allowed to cover what was happening. We were told to leave the park entirely. Aston Park is on the top of a hill. So if we had left the park entirely, we would have no ability to cover what was happening.
Were they telling you to leave the park in the way they were telling the others to leave the park? Or were they telling you specifically, we're going to arrest or deal with the unhoused here, but you as journalists just need to leave? Is that what they were basically saying?
We're being addressed in basically the same way. Everybody in the park had to leave. Okay. And we have that on body cam footage now that they actually said, let's get the standing ones first because they're videotaping.
You alluded to the police releasing the body cam footage. I wanted to get to that. Obviously, you've combed through that probably very studiously.
12 hours.
We've reviewed all of it at this point. I think we're the only publication to do so far.
So what did you see in your review of that body cam footage that supports your position on this, or that was new information that maybe, oh, I didn't see this, even furthers our argument here, or perhaps is maybe inconclusive or damning from your vantage point?
It was pretty thoroughly in the direction of damning for them, that their actions were not in accordance with the First Amendment, like protecting that freedom. So yeah, you definitely have this, let's go for the people who are videotaping first. You even have one officer saying after Veronica had been arrested, of course, misgendering me, but saying like, this member of the press, I wonder if they're going to wise up now that their colleague has been arrested. They were wondering out loud to themselves or to the cop next to them if I was going to relent now that I had seen my colleague arrested, which is honestly more news. Like if I'm in a park monitoring an event and I see press getting arrested, I'm definitely going to want to document that.
First, Veronica was targeted.
Absolutely.
I have to say, body cam footage shows Veronica 5 times in the course of a single interaction being, I am a member of the press. I am here covering a story. The purpose of the press is to monitor things like this. And this isn't, you'll have to take our word for it. Just today on our Twitter and our social media, we posted a video that is cut, that has a lot of this cut together, where you can see police identifying our journalist first. They told everyone in the park to leave. They were singling out our journalist first, since they're videotaping their words, arrested them first. Hope that the arrest of Veronica would intimidate Matilda away. Matilda kept doing her job, insisted on her rights. She gets arrested. And this is out there for everyone to see now. There are 12 hours of footage.
Video 2 and 14 are really key.
Yeah, they are if you're watching the whole thing. And we've had some coverage on our social media and on our Patreon, which is, people can subscribe to our Patreon, but the posts there are public for anyone to read. We're doing a longer form piece on all of it, but we already have a video out on our social media that's kind of like the cliff notes of the arrest of our journalist.
What are the charges that you are still facing?
Trespassing.
That's it. Merely trespassing under the premise that you trespassed past the 10 p.m. curfew. Is that what that is? Why do you think, now I imagine you've been in conversation with the district attorney's office. Why do you think these charges, especially since this footage is out there now, you identified yourself clearly. You said Veronica 5 times on video is seen identifying themselves 5 times as press on video. Why do you think these charges are still pending? Why do you think you're still facing these charges?
I haven't directly talked with any of those folks, but I can say that what our lawyer has reported to us is that they're trying to make a case that we were not actually journalists.
Yes. And they've essentially said this in public, or the city has said this in public.
Yeah.
I think I would know the answer to this, that there's a certain bias, I guess, about recognized journalism. Press freedom organizations have come forward. Tell me about the kind of support you're getting from attorneys and others who are in a position to support and advocate for the press. Tell me about that. What's been happening?
From the start, we've had tremendous support from press freedom organizations. And we had the Committee to Protect Journalists, which covers actually like murders of journalists across the world. You have them basically making a post within the week. You have other organizations jumping on, like the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker reported on our arrest almost immediately. And then you have their parent organization, Freedom of the Press Foundation. They've just been amazing.
When this is worth, I think, noting for the larger impact in this, the ACLU, who was key, the ACLU of North Carolina, who were key in joining those other organizations, really pushing for this body cam footage to be released. And there's a lot in that footage. It is not just our journalists there, but reveals a lot about there were unhoused people there, the treatment of the protesters. And there's a lot to cover there. But definitely, I think it was key that they, as one press freedom person I talked to said, it's not a smoking gun, it's a smoking arsenal. Right. They repeatedly point out journalists. And I will point out, The Blade is the only publication in town that's gotten treated this way. And now we have, for only the 4th time in the country since 2018, journalists being taken to trial for doing their jobs. And I think it definitely shows, like, beneath the progressive veneer, this is who Asheville's governments and legal structure are when the chips are down. They are treating our publication differently because we are openly critical of the police. You mentioned recognized journalists and publications. They may have like more of a, be more established, more prestigious, whatever. But they also tend to be more deferential to institutions like the police department, less likely to be immediately critical.
I can't imagine this actually going in front of a, like, attorneys arguing in front of a jury or a judge about this case. I can't see that happening. What are your attorneys telling you is likely going to happen?
It seems like they're going to do this, that they're going to bring us up and have proceedings.
Let's draw that string out. Let's say that on the mere trespassing charge, a judge finds, or the jury says, they were there after 10 p.m. That makes them guilty on the very letter of the ordinance.
Yeah.
What's the penalty? What do you face?
A maximum fine of $200, maximum jail stay of 20 days. It's not just a trespassing charge. I think that like some folks online are just like, oh, why don't they just pay the fines? For one thing, that would set a precedent that any journalist who is like technically not doing something according to law, even though they're news gathering,
Or even just, something the cops cite and make up.
Exactly. Yeah. And who knows, like, when it gets to court. But yeah, that would happen. We're ready to fight this until the end.
Yeah.
If for some reason we lose a bench trial, we're going to appeal.
Yes. I think that's worth saying. Obviously, there's stuff we can discuss publicly and stuff not. Though, honestly, all the evidence is basically out there in the public eye at this point. And you can clearly see our journalists were there observing, acting as journalists. It's a bit hard to argue that a news organization, a leftist news organization, but news organization has been around for nearly a decade, has a long record of covering all sorts of topics in the city, these exact issues, aren't journalists in our news organization. And Matilda mentioned the larger struggle here. I think when this was brought up at a city council public safety committee meeting, I think not even a month after this, after the arrest happened, Councilor Kim Roney, who's the closest thing to a dissenter on council, pressed on this a little bit. And the response of the city attorney and the city manager was basically, the police decide who counts as a journalist. And everyone, whether you agree with everything we print or not, should find that absolutely chilling.
I didn't know that had happened, that's something the city manager said, that the police should decide who's a journalist or who isn't.
Our article, The War on the Poor, which kind of deals with a lot of these different issues, but delves into some of that. But yeah, it was the late January public safety committee meeting.
That's pretty chilling.
It is very chilling. That is Asheville. And I think the reaction to this has combined with the drumbeat that you're seeing. You mentioned the chamber and the TDA and the meeting they put up there. The drumbeat we're seeing towards the only answer to anything is more police, more arrest, more jail time. Also, Asheville's culture, sadly, including around media, is used to being way too deferential. Mm-hmm. So when you have media organizations that are like, no, we're going to like directly criticize council members, we're going to directly criticize the police, we're going to investigate these things from a very critical perspective, that's taken as a threat.
And I really don't understand this, is how city council, you mentioned Kim Roney, the most progressive member of this council, at least demonstrably progressive. Why isn't there more outcry from city leaders like, this is BS, stop it, let's drop these charges?
This is obviously happening in Asheville with an all Democratic council that's supposedly a progressive government, though I think that veneer doesn't hold up to scrutiny very well. I wrote a column that it was entitled Asheville Has a Right-Wing City Council. But I think that issue definitely deserves a lot more scrutiny, because and this is a long theme in Asheville, the facade and the reality are two very different things.
Matilda, how are you feeling now heading into this? Are you worried? Are you concerned, or do you feel emboldened and supported?
I will not say I haven't been worried at times, but the level of support, especially from the organizations like Freedom of the Press Foundation and the ACLU, NC Policy Watch did an article on our charges in the situation. Now that the body cam footage is revealed, it's even more telling of what happened there. It's almost impossible to really play off in the way that they've been playing it off as far as like the city and APD. And we've been getting even more support since those videos have come out. We're confident, and a lot can happen in a situation like this, a bench trial. It's up to one individual, but we're confident. We like our lawyer. We think in the end it's going to really backfire for them. Oh, I love it in the evening when something
beautiful comes into my mind. I'd like to thank my guests today, David Forbes and Matilda Bliss of the Asheville Blade. If you have something to say on this subject, leave a message on the Overlook line at 984-278-7301. The Overlook is a production of Podcast Asheville. Our theme music, Maker's Song, comes courtesy of the Asheville band The Resonant Rogues. New episodes of The Overlook are available at 6 a.m. weekday mornings, and you can get all our episodes in a single email by subscribing to our weekly newsletter at podavl.com. I'm Matt Pike, and I'll see you on the next episode of The Overlook.